So this evening, I'll be reading some Ajahn Lee Dhammadharo. This is a compilation put together and translated by Ajahn Jeff. And it's a quite eclectic compilation, all of which are from essentially his oral teachings, some of which are short notes written down by disciples, others are more or less complete talks from tape recorders. I think, as was mentioned earlier, when someone else read something of Ajahn Lee's, he was essentially a prolific writer by Forest Ajahn standards. And I find that these oral teachings as well are really helpful, and they provide a very different flavor than his writings. So I'll start here at the beginning, and then I'll skip towards more of the middle.
What's the name of the book?
Oh, Skill of Release. So, by way of introduction, I like going different places, not just for the fun of it, but also because I want to learn. To learn something of value depends on three things: seeing, listening, and thinking, i.e., using all of your senses so as to serve a purpose. Sometimes when you meet people and find that their beliefs and practices are on a level lower than yours, you can serve a purpose by teaching them to get them started on the right path. But when you see with your eyes, hear with your ears, and are convinced in your heart that something is really good, don't think about whether it's yours or theirs. Remember it and put it into practice. Because my heart has been set on serving the purpose of the religion, I've kept on trying to do what's good. No matter whether I'm in a high place or a lowly one, I always think only of serving a purpose. As for the question of manners, in other words, how to benefit advanced people and people not so advanced, that depends on the situation. The religion isn't the exclusive property of homes or monasteries, of this or that city or nation. The religion is something meant to benefit everyone everywhere. It belongs to the world. The further we can spread its benefits, the better. Even though I've meant well, practicing in line with these thoughts, I can't escape being criticized, probably because the people who criticize don't understand. Just a short while back, last April 20th, I was talking with an old nobleman, but didn't want to come down too hard on him. His criticism, to put it briefly, was, quote, "You spend an awful lot of time involved with lay people, so how can you practice for the sake of release?" I answered him frankly, but first I asked him, just to make sure, "What are you getting at?" "Teach people to reach Nibbana," he said. "Don't get too involved with them." So I said, "I like teaching people to reach Nibbana, but it's hard. I like it, mind you, I like it, but if I did it as you said, I'd be crazy. Suppose you plant some rice. When it's golden and ripe, you can harvest just the white grain. Can you harvest just the white grains of rice without taking anything else? I take everything. People may say I'm crazy, but why should I care? I take the whole plant because it has lots of uses. The straw you can keep to feed the water buffaloes, or sell, or use as kindling. As for the rice husks, you can use them to feed pigs." "You know," he said, "you're right." And that was the end of the matter. I'm different from most other monks in that I don't like to eat only one flavor of food, i.e., the physical food we eat every day. I like the kind of food that has three flavors in every bite. It's a fine food, food for the heart, not food for the body. Its three flavors are the food of sensory contact, the food of consciousness, and the food of intentions. If you were to compare it to durian fruit, it's the type that's sweet and rich and a little bit bitter all at once, the kind of durian that people really love to eat. The nourishment of the food of sensory contact here means likable sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations and ideas. The nourishment of the food of consciousness means taking note of likable things by way of the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And the nourishment of intentions means the success of the good things we aim at. Taken together, these things are called dhamma food, three flavors in a single bite. Whoever keeps eating this kind of food regularly will have a long, happy, and healthy life. This is the kind of food I want. To put it in simple terms, it's the sense of satisfaction I get when I see my students, monks, novices, and laypeople, practicing rightly. This isn't rice food, it's people food. I'm a monster monk. I like to eat people. If anyone acts in a way to make me feel happy and satisfied, that's going to help me live longer. If anyone misbehaves, that's going to make me die faster. The reason I'm here is to help benefit the religion, to benefit the world. I'm looking for a living, hoping to make a profit. If the rice I plant produces big, fat grains and good profits, I'll hang around for a good while. If all that I get are stunted grains and nothing but losses, I'll be on my way. So if I see that staying on will serve a purpose, I'll try to breathe good and long, good and long. If I see that staying on doesn't serve a purpose anymore, I'll try to breathe shorter and shorter until I go in an instant. That's when I can be at my ease, the kind of happiness that nothing else can match. With no need to sit here tormenting my body, listening to anyone else's troubles anymore, shining bright, all by myself, with no worries or concerns at all. So that's the kind of food I like. As for food for the body, I eat it because I have to, that's all. It's not that I really want it, for there's no real substance to it. You can eat it today and tomorrow, and you have to get rid of it. But with food for the heart, what you eat in one day can stay with you for 10 years, 100 years. You never grow tired of it, and you stay full until you forget what it's like to be hungry. This chapter is called Why Meditate. Wherever there are effects, there always has to be causes. The world we experience comes from the heart and its cause. If the heart is good, the world will have to be good. If the heart is bad, the world will have to be bad. The mind, when it's not the body in the present, is world. When it's with the body in the present, it's Dhamma. If it's world, it has to be as hot as fire. If it's Dhamma, it's as cool as water. Don't be complacent. Remind yourself that we're all being chased around the world day by day. In other words, aging rears up, illness roars, and death runs up the score. So don't be oblivious, partying around with your defilements. Associate with the qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha until your mind develops right concentration. That way, you won't have anything to fear from the dangers of the world. Believing other people is all right, but it's not really special. It's like borrowing money. We'll have to share the return on our investment with our lenders. When we don't yet know, can't yet have any real conviction in ourselves, and still have to believe what other people say, it's like being an infant who has to depend on its parents. If we don't get stronger, we'll have to keep being nursed all the way through old age. If we don't try to train the mind until it's firm and unwavering, it won't give rise to the strength of concentration, and we'll have to keep on being a child. When we're able to shake off all the issues in the mind, leaving just the mind in and of itself, three gems will appear in it, the gem of the Buddha, the gem of the Dhamma, and the gem of the Sangha. Once these three gems appear within us, we won't have to load ourselves down by carrying around much of anything else. Simply put them under your arm if you like, or even up your nose. When you have this kind of wealth, your mind can be light, and noble treasures will arise within you. In other words, conviction in the qualities of the Buddha will appear in the mind. Then you practice in line with those qualities until you gain the various results that they have to offer. You'll see the true Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha in your heart. If you try to take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha on the outer level, you're going to die for sure. The Buddha on the outer level entered Nibbana a long time ago. The Dhamma on the outer level is just letters and books. The Sangha on the outer level is the monks with shaven heads and yellow robes that you see roaming all over the country. If you try to hold on to these things, it's like carrying a heavy hoe that won't do you any good. But if you hold on to the virtues of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha within you, and then put them into practice, you realize that what you're looking for is right here in the heart. And then what do you want? To return to the human state? To attain a heavenly state? To attain Nibbana? Or go to hell? They're all possible, without your having to look for them anywhere else. The Buddha taught that the five aggregates are a heavy burden, because they all get to the point where we can't bear carrying them around anymore and have to throw them down in the mud. If you don't keep cleansing them, they keep getting heavier and heavier. If you then try to go depending on other people, you weigh them down, and you yourself are helpless. This is because stashing things away in the heart is like taking pictures without ever developing the film. When what you eat gets put on the film, what you say gets put on the film, what you hear gets put on the film, but that's as far as it gets on the film. You've never stopped to look at what kind of pictures you have, pretty or ugly. If you want to see your pictures, you have to take the film into the dark room by closing your eyes and practicing concentration, attaining the first jhana, directing your thoughts to the present and evaluating it until you can see yourself clearly. If you don't go into the dark room now, someday the king of death is going to blindfold you, tie up your feet and hands, and drag you into his dark room. In other words, when you're on the verge of death, you won't be able to open your mouth or eyes. Nobody will be able to feed you. You'll want to eat, but won't be able to eat. You'll want to speak, but won't be able to speak. Your ears will get closed off so that you can't hear anything clearly. You won't be able to see your parents, family, children, or grandchildren. You won't be able to tell them your last wishes. That's called the dark room of the king of death. The mind is the only thing that senses pleasure and pain. The body has no sense of these things at all. It's like taking a knife to murder someone. They don't hunt down the knife and punish it. They punish only the person who used it to commit the murder. If your mind isn't good, then the goodness of your actions isn't really good, and the goodness of your words isn't really good either. You have to develop power within yourself, like stocking up on gunpowder. If a gun has no gunpowder, it can't be used to destroy anything. People who have to be servants are the ones who lack the power to be anyone else's boss. As for the people who have that power, all they have to do is point their fingers and other people will jump up and run. If we don't develop our own powers, we'll have to be servants, slaves to defilement, throughout time. The body is like a knife. If you have a knife but don't keep sharpening it, it will get coated thick with rust. In the same way, if you have a body, physical elements, aggregates, and sense media, but you don't train it, and keep it polished, it'll get coated thick with defilements. If it were a gun, it wouldn't even kill a fly. Normally, the mind doesn't like to stay where it is. It keeps flowing out the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body, like a river that splits into five streams instead of flowing as one. In a river like that, the force of the currents is weakened and can't run at full strength. In addition to flowing out the five senses, the mind also leaks out through thoughts of the past and future instead of staying firm in the present. This is why the mind has no peace or strength, because it never gets to rest. When the mind loses strength, the body loses strength as well and won't be able to succeed at anything. If the mind doesn't stay with the body in the present and instead wanders around exposed to external perceptions, it's bound to get into all sorts of difficulties, just like a person who doesn't stay in his house and instead goes running around outside. He's bound to be exposed to sun and rain. He may get run over by a car or bitten by a rabid dog. If we stay in our home, even though There may still be some dangers. They won't be too serious, and we won't get into difficulties. When the mind isn't quiet, it's like running around with a flaming torch. You're bound to burn yourself. Only when you stop running will you be able to cool down. People who accumulate merit but don't develop a heart's foundation are like people who own land but don't have a deed. They might be able to sell it for money, but they're an easy mark for a swindler because they don't have any firm basis for their claim. If you practice generosity and virtue but not meditation, the heart's foundation, it's like taking a bath on a hot day only from the waist down. If you don't bathe all the way from the head on down, you won't get totally refreshed because the coolness doesn't go all the way into the heart. External merit, generosity and virtue, is like the skin of a fruit. Internal merit, meditation, is like the flesh of the fruit. You can't have one without the other. If fruit doesn't have skin, its flesh won't grow. If it has skin but no flesh, you can't eat it. Each helps the other, but they differ in quality. External merit is what protects internal merit, while the internal merit nourishes merit outside. Today I'm going to talk about how to drill a well. This is a difficult skill, not like simply digging or plowing. We all want happiness, but we don't really know what happiness is. Real happiness is nothing other than the inner worth and skillfulness of the heart. So where are we going to find inner worth? Inner worth is like a well. The first kind of well is simply a depression in the ground for catching rainwater, like a pond. We can't get too much use out of this kind of well because there are times when water buffaloes, cattle, and other animals get in the water and bathe and drink, making it muddy. If you want to use the water, you have to filter it many times. This kind of well is like generosity, which only gives shallow rewards, like the water in a shallow depression. The second kind of well is like a deep reservoir. Cattle can't bathe or drink in it. The only animals that go into the reservoir are toads and frogs. But even so, if we want to use the water, we have to filter it first. This kind of well is like the virtue of observing the precepts, which gives deeper rewards than generosity. The third kind of well is an artisan well with a constantly running spring. No matter how much water you use, it never runs dry. This kind of well is so deep that even mosquitoes, your defilements, can't get down into the water. To drill this kind of well, you need to use a drill with a diamond bit and a strong steel shaft if you want to reach the underground water. This kind of well is like meditation, because you have to use strong mindfulness, discernment, persistence, and endurance if you want to succeed at drilling. Mindfulness has to be like the diamond bit, and endurance, the steel shaft. When you use your persistence to drill down, the results will arise as inner worth and skillfulness that keep flowing in, bathing the mind, like the waters of immortality that provide the mind with a constant stream of refreshment and delight. If we don't have a safe place for our inner worth, how is it going to help us? It's like raising horses or cows, but not fencing in a place for them to stay. If they go wandering off, it's your fault, not theirs. If you don't practice virtue, concentration, and discernment on your own, then you're going to get taken in by the symbols of refuge and never get to the real thing. The symbols of refuge are Buddha images, which are just symbols of the Buddha, Buddhist texts, which are symbols of the Dhamma, and the Buddhist monks and nuns, who are symbols of those who have practiced rightly and well until becoming noble disciples. If you get stuck on the outer level, you'll never meet with the real thing. Inner worth is like money. If your pocket has a hole, it'll let your money slip right through. If you do things that give rise to inner worth, but don't keep that worth in your heart, it won't stay with you. When you're about to die and you can call on it to help you, what will there be to answer your call? When this is the case, you can't criticize all the good things you've done for not helping you. You have put the blame on yourself. If you stick a dollar in your pocket, but your pocket is torn, Then when the time comes to buy a cup of coffee, you won't have any money to buy it. In that case, what are you going to blame? Who are you going to blame? The money or your pocket? To practice meditation is like harvesting your crop of inner worth and eating it. If you don't harvest it, it'll spoil. If you eat it in time, it'll nourish your body. If you don't eat it in time, it'll go to waste. If you don't take your take your inner worth into your heart, you'll never feel full. Generosity is something that poor people can't practice, but crazy people can. Virtue is something that crazy people can't practice, but poor people can. As for meditation, everyone can practice it, no matter what their age, sex, or station in life. A mind without concentration is like a pile of wooden posts left lying on the ground for people and animals to step all over. But if we stand the posts up and plant them in the soil, we can get good use out of them. Even if they're not tall, only a meter or so, but we put them close together in a line, we can fence in our yard and prevent people and animals from coming and traipsing all over our property. It's the same with the mind. If we take a firm stance in concentration as our hearts, as the heart's foundation, keeping our mindfulness and alertness close together in line, we can keep defilements from slipping into the mind and making it soiled. The Dhamma is something constant and true. The reason we don't see the truth is because we're always on the move. If we're riding in a car, we can't clearly see the things that pass near us, nearby on the road, such as how big the stones on the ground are, their color or shape. We'll look at trees and mountains, and they all seem to be on the move. If we've been in the car since birth, without stopping to get out and walk around on our own, we're sure to think that cars run, trees run, and mountains run. What we see isn't in line with the truth. The running is in us, in the car, not in the mountains and trees. Whoever develops concentration will end up with three eyes. In other words, your outer left eye will see good things, your outer right eye will see bad things, and they'll send them to the inner eye, which will remain normal. You'll also have three ears. Your outer left ear will hear praise, your outer right ear will hear criticism, and they'll send them to the inner ear, which will stay normal. This is how you can receive all the guests the world sends your way. As for the eye of the mind, intuitive insight, it will receive your defilements. Once it really understands them, it will be able to send them packing. That way, you won't be able to live in the world without suffering. That way, you'll be able to live in the world without suffering. If you really apply yourself, you can accomplish all kinds of things, even with a single pocket knife. In the same way, if you really apply yourself to making the mind still, you can get much better results than a person who studies and memorizes hundreds and thousands of texts. Making the mind still is something we can all do. If it were beyond our powers, the Buddha wouldn't have taught us to do it. The paths and fruitions leading to Nibbana aren't the property of stupid people, and they don't belong to smart people either. They belong to those who are true and really determined in developing goodness for themselves. The body is like a mountain containing all kinds of minerals. There is gold, silver, and diamond ore buried here in this rock, i.e., the unconditioned is in there. There's also the conditioned, which is like trees, weeds, dirt, and rocks, where all sorts of people and animals, monkeys, tigers, and elephants, dwell. As for the gold and silver, they're not a dwelling place for animals at all. So if we act like monkeys, tigers, and elephants, we'll meet up with nothing but trees, weeds, dirt, and rocks. We'll never meet up with the things of value, like silver or gold. To act like monkeys means that we never apply ourselves to anything. We wander everywhere, with no fixed place to eat or sleep, swinging from branch to branch as we feel like it. What this means is that our minds have no firm place to stay, no concentration. We wander here and there in the past and future in our thoughts and moods, with no time to stop and stay in place. This is what it means to act like a monkey. As for tigers, they're violent and fierce. This stands for the anger that arises in the human heart and erupts outward, smothering whatever goodness we may have. As for elephants, they like to hear nothing but sweet words and praise. They can't take criticism at all. This is like people who, when they do something wrong, can't stand to be told that it's wrong. If they do something right and they get a little praise, they smile until their cheeks hurt. This is what it is. This is what it means to be like an elephant. So we have to get rid of the monkeys, tigers, and elephants in ourselves so that we can turn into human beings. That way we can look at our mountain and realize that if we want valuable things, we'll be able to get valuable things out of it. If we want worthless things, we'll get worthless things out of it. We can then gather all kinds of treasures. We can level the dirt and turn it into fields. We can take the rocks and extract the silver and gold. As for the trees, we can cut them down and turn them into firewood or charcoal so that we can cook our food and fire our smelter, or else turn them into posts and boards so that we can build ourselves a home. All of these things we'll be able to get from our mountain, but we have to apply ourselves and really be present. If we want silver and gold, we have to set up a smelter and heat the rocks to see which elements are there in pure form, the unconditioned, and which ones are mixed, the conditioned. This is how we do it. 1. We have to get a lot of fuel. 2. We have to set up a furnace. And 3. We have to start a fire. Only then will we be able to extract the ore from our rock. Finding lots of fuel means being willing to let go of things both inside and out. As for setting up a furnace, we have to find a place with good solid ground and a roof that doesn't leak. This stands for our persistence. Once we've got our furnace, we start a fire. This refers to the ardency of our practice. Once our practice is ardent, the various elements in our rock, the body, will melt and separate out on their own, just as when they melt down minerals, the silver, lead, and tin, etc., will separate out on their own. The same holds true with the body. When it undergoes ardent inspection by the mind, the pure ore and the various impurities will separate out of their own accord. But most meditators nowadays want to separate things out even before they've put their rock into the smelter. They think things out on their own without a single one of the tools needed for smelting. No fuel, no furnace, no fire, a leaky roof and a piece of caved-in ground. What are they going to smelt? They say that the transcendent has to be like this. Insight meditation has to be like that. Stream entry has to be like this. You have to let go like this and that in order to reach this and that stage. The stages of once returning, non-returning, and arhatship have to be reached in this and that way. The four levels of jhana have to be done in this and that way. They try to separate things out in line with their own ideas, but no matter how much they try, they can't get things to separate because they don't have any fuel, any fire, any furnace. Where are they going to get any results? Results don't come from thinking. They come from the qualities we build into the mind. So don't try to separate things out in line with your own notions. Some people see a person carrying a big hunk of rock to his home and think he's a stupid fool. First of all, the rock is heavy. And besides, what can there be of any value in a plain old rock? So they take a shovel to the mountain to dig up only the silver and gold. Not too much, just some tiny little nuggets to wrap up and carry back home in a cloth. But they end up with nothing at all because the nuggets they want are firmly embedded in the mountain. They'll need more than a shovel to get them out. As for the stupid person, as soon as he gets home, he clears out a space, builds a furnace, gathers fuel, starts a fire, and throws the rock in. When the rock is subjected to strong heat, the various ores in the rock will begin to melt and to separate. The silver will come seeping out and go one way, the gold another, the tin and lead another, the diamond another, without getting mixed. This way, the stupid person will be able to choose the silver, gold, and diamond as he likes. As for the people who think they're intelligent, who know that this and that is that, that you have to reach this level before you can reach that level, that concentration is like this, insight meditation is like that, the transcendent is like this, in the end, they have nothing to swallow but their own saliva. they gain no valuables at all. The person who thinks he's stupid when he encounters something has to keep contemplating, reflecting, digging away until he comes to an understanding. If we want happiness, we have to give rise to the causes. 1. Gather a lot of fuel. What this means is that we're willing to give up the sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations, and ideas within ourselves, as well as being generous with outside things by making donations, observing the precepts, and practicing meditation. This is how we burn away our defilements through the perfection of generosity, chagaparami. The perfection of generosity is excellent fuel for roasting our defilements. 2. Set up a furnace. This stands for the effort we put into abandoning physical pleasure and sitting in meditation. Thinking of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha is a way of calming the mind. Then we keep pumping the breath into the body in the same way that they pump air into the furnace for casting a bronze Buddha image. We make the heart steady and firm with mindfulness and alertness, constantly in control. The way the inner fire of our ardency will get stronger and stronger. As we keep pumping the breath in, the sense of inner light will get brighter and brighter. Once you're able to keep this up, gather your body and mind together into one. Don't try to crack or divide them up at all, for that's the way a fool who thinks he knows everything beforehand. As the fire of our ardency keeps getting stronger, the various elements of the body will melt and separate out of their own accord. When you practice the Dhamma, don't worry about how it's going to go. Don't try to plan or arrange things to go this way or that. When the fire of your practice reaches full strength, all the various impurities will fall away on their own, leaving just the pure ore. The rock clinging to the ore, the various hindrances, nivarana, will fall away from the heart. But if your furnace is full of holes, the fire will flicker outside and the heat inside will dissipate. You won't be able to burn away the heart's various impurities. So you have to learn how to act like a person making charcoal. 3. Start a fire. When people make charcoal, they start their fire and then close off the furnace, i.e. we close off our senses, leaving just a tiny air vent, i.e. our nose. With the furnace entirely closed off in this way, the wood they place in the furnace won't burn up or turn into ashes. When they finally open the furnace, they'll find hard, high-quality charcoal. In the same way, once we can remember our meditation word without getting distracted, the closing off of the furnace means that we close off the various perceptions that register by way of the ears, eyes, nose, tongue, body, and intellect. We close off the hindrances and don't let the mind flicker out after outside perceptions. Once everything is closed off in this way, the wood will keep smoldering away in the furnace. When the time comes to open it up, we'll find that there are no ashes and that we've ended up with good, hard charcoal of high quality. The solid goodness we develop in the heart is like charcoal that we can then use to smelt our ore. This way, the elements within us will gain strength, able to separate themselves into the conditioned and the unconditioned. Once we give rise to the 4 stages of jhana, unskillful mental states, the rock will separate out and fall away. Sensual desire will separate out. Ill will, torpor and lethargy, restlessness and anxiety and uncertainty will all separate out and fall away. The mind will be totally absorbed in jhana, with the directed thought and valuation in charge. Just this is enough for insight to arise. We'll be able to see clearly what's diamond, what's silver, and what's gold. The silver, in this sense, is the sense of fullness or rapture. The gold is a sense of pleasure and ease that arises within. Once there's pleasure, no disturbances will appear in the mind, like a burning lantern when there's no wind to disturb the flame. This is the light of the Dhamma, Tammopadipo, or the brilliance of discernment, Panya Pajoto. Insight meditation, i.e. insight meditation, arising. We'll see the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha within. The heart will give rise to treasures. This is like setting up a furnace and using charcoal to smelt ore. The various elements in the rock will separate out, leaving the unconditioned. Insight meditation is the fire we use to heat the rock. If we want things to separate out like this, we have to use insight meditation. Don't try to separate things out on your own. Whatever is going to turn into light, ashes, charcoal, or smoke will do so of its own accord. This is how we get past the conditioned. The unconditioned will separate out to one side, the conditioned to another. This way, we'll get to see what's really true. But however things separate out, you have to keep using your discernment even further. If you get attached to good things, they can backfire on you. If you get attached to the bad, you've gone wrong. I thought it was very interesting there. It was towards the beginning, I noticed, where he used the four nutriments. But in the suttas, of course, the metaphors given are, you know, you could say like negative, you know, you're supposed to not be attached to these things. But in there, he gives a very wonderful example of how they can be used to transform, or how he uses them essentially to delight in things. Do you have any other reflections on that? Or?
In the sense because it's as a nutriment, and you're using it, and he's turning it into something that is actually feeding and nourishing. The way that the Buddha. There's only a few suttas with the using the nutriment, but the Buddha tends to use it as a something that that we pay attention to in order to relinquish. They're both valid and useful to contemplate.
Ajahn Lee talks a lot about effort and persistence, and I was wondering which of the three unwholesome roots is usually most significant when in terms of laziness.
Say it's a general thing of delusion. Mm. It's a function of moha, because it clouds the mind. As a generality, but also as a reality, we can wear ourselves out with desire and aversion, so that the mind just wants to shut off after it's sort of run around with negativity or hankering after things. So. To get a break on it by dozing off. So, in general, one would say, if you're looking at one, moha is a quality that clouds the mind.